This is episode number 199 with Jacob Leaf. Welcome to the School of Greatness. My name is Lewis Howes, former pro athlete turned lifestyle entrepreneur. And each week we bring you an inspiring person or message to help you discover how to unlock your inner greatness. Thanks for spending some time with me today. Now let the class begin. Welcome everyone to today's episode, very special episode with a guy by the name of Jacob Leaf, who has dedicated the last 15 years of his life to serving people and to serving a specific community to change their entire mindset, their entire process, their entire way of living, to have it all in life, to improve their lifestyle in a place where poverty is extreme, to improve their education process, to improve the way people feel about themselves. And for those who want to learn how to make a bigger impact, who want to start serving in a deeper way, and who want to learn how to do this for themselves, then this is the episode for you. His name is Jacob Leaf. I'm going to give you a little bit more of an intro about him here in just a second when I get started, but this is all about living a life of service. Again, one of the principles of my book that's coming out later this year is living a life of service. That's one of the principles of greatness. And Jacob has done an incredible job doing that and serving people. And, you know, he's done it for 15 years, done it since he was in college. And it's a really powerful story. He's also got a book out called I Am Because You Are, How the Spirit of Ubuntu Inspired an Unlikely Friendship and Transformed a Community. So this is a powerful episode, guys. I hope you get a lot out of these stories and, you're inspired by it. I want you guys to take action from this. Make sure to share this episode, lewishowes.com/199. You'll get all the links to the information and the resources that we talked about in this episode. So excited about this, and I'll talk to you guys more at the end. But without further ado, I want to dive into this episode with the one, the only, Jacob Leaf.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4 times points on your top 2 eligible spending categories every month, like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4 times points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
There are over 75 million monthly Tubi viewers. That's more people than there are influencers on the internet. Which means Tubi is more popular than sponsored posts for digestive enzymes and high coverage foundation. More popular than soft launching your boyfriend. More popular than making boomers explode with rage when you tell them how much you make on a single post. Tubi, it's more popular than influencers. See you in there.
Escape to Ocean City, Maryland, and discover a place that just feels lighter, where every day feels like Saturday and French fries are a food group, where flip-flops are always in fashion and seafood is always in season, where the boardwalk is bustling and the beach is right outside your door, where you can rise with the tide and feel like a kid again. Ocean City, Maryland, somewhere to smile about. Book your trip at OCOcean.com.
Welcome everyone back to the School of Greatness podcast. Very excited about today's guest. His name is Jacob Leaf, and he is the co-founder and CEO of Ubuntu Education Fund. And in 2010, he was named a young global leader by the World Economic Forum. And in 2012, was selected as a member of the Clinton Global Initiative Advisory Board. He splits his time between Brooklyn, New York, and South Africa. Welcome, Jacob, to the show.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing fantastic. I'm very excited about this. We were just having a conversation about some mutual friends with Adam Braun and a lot of other people at Summit Series. So I'm excited to hopefully meet you in person one day, even though this is over the phone right now.
Sounds good.
Yeah. So next time in New York, I'll have to come by the offices.
Absolutely.
But you've got a new book out, and I've actually never heard of you until my publisher, Rodale, which is your publisher, said you got to connect with this guy and you got to learn about this guy. You'll really love his story. And you've got this book out that's called I Am Because You Are. It's how the spirit of Ubuntu inspired an unlikely friendship and transformed a community. And can you start us back with your first time you went to South Africa and what opened up for you when you traveled there?
Sure. So I was, I'm American, and my family moved to the United Kingdom when I was 13 years old. So I get to London. It's a big city. I moved from a sleepy suburb in New Jersey. And before I knew it, I was getting into a lot of trouble. I was having a hard time sort of fitting in and so forth. And I, one day I came across this giant march in Hyde Park, and it was a Free Mandela march. It was to, you know, end apartheid, keep economic embargoes on, and ultimately the release of Nelson Mandela from prison. And before I know it, I started volunteering, and it just inspired me. I'd never been to South Africa. I had no connection to the continent, but it was the music, the colors, and maybe this just need to be part of something bigger than who I was. I have no idea, to be honest, what it was, but I was sucked into this. And, you know, volunteering when you're 13 years old means handing out envelopes, licking stamps, you know, nothing too exciting. But when I was 17, in 1994, they decided the elections were coming to South Africa. And they decided they would take 15 of us from 15 different countries down to observe the transition to democracy.
Wow.
And, you know, 17, and I grew up in privilege. I had two parents who went to university. I went to good schools. I had, you know, it was a very easy life in a lot of ways. So it was probably harder for me to have failed than succeeded.
Mm-hmm.
And I get down to South Africa, and we toured the country, meeting with everyone from sort of your right-wing neo-Nazis, your Eugene Terre Blanches, and sort of everyone on the other side, your Robben Island freedom fighters. People spent their life imprisoned with Nelson Mandela and so forth. One evening, I was in an area called Alexandria, which is shacks as far as you can see, and it sits in the shadows of Sandton, which is the economic hub of the continent. It's right in the middle of Johannesburg, looks like Lower Manhattan, huge skyscrapers. And I come across this woman, and she's, and this is really what changed my life, or my sort of moment that drew me to the country. And she was quite old and quite large. And, you know, you're 17, you think you know everything, right? You're overconfident. And she says to me, and we start talking, she tells me she's waited in line for 30 hours to cast her ballot.
Huh.
And I'm thinking, I look, take one look at her, I'm like, I don't understand. You've waited 30 hours? And she taps me on the head and says, no, boy, you don't understand. I've waited 85 years. And she walked away.
Wow.
And I'm 17, and that just shook me to my very core. And it was sort of that moment when I said I want to become part of what they were calling the New South Africa.
Wow. That just gave me chills. So you're 17, you're 17 when this happened.
Yeah.
And you're only there for what, like a week or two, or how long were you
there? We were there for 6 weeks touring the country, but that was towards the end of the visit, and I heard a woman speak the next day who was working on the new constitution, and she was a professor at University of Pennsylvania, and I'm thinking, oh, this will be my ticket back to South Africa, because I was getting ready to graduate high school. I'll apply to college in the States, and I'll go to UPenn, and she'll help me get back. So I apply, I get in, and I go down there and go to find this woman. She's a law professor who wants, of course, nothing to do with an 18-year-old. But I bug her and bug her, and we become friends. And I had, we just got internet in our dorm, and I found a job down in Cape Town. I'm like, this is great. I bring it to this professor, Dr. Mary Frances Barry. She was a U.S. Commissioner on Civil Rights and a big anti-apartheid activist and so forth. And she says to me, okay, we'll sponsor you. You go down there for 6 months. And I get down to South Africa, and of course, there was no job waiting for me in Cape Town. It was a complete scam. And I'm thinking, God, I can't call this woman and tell her this, you know, what am I going to do? And so I left Cape Town that evening, and I got on a train, and I didn't really know where I was going. About 18 hours into this train ride, a guy convinced me to get off in a place called Port Elizabeth, South Africa. And Port Elizabeth, I like to say, it's an industrial port town on the Indian Ocean side. It's one of these places you leave, you don't go to. It's, I hope not to offend anyone, sort of like a Detroit of, you know, South Africa.
Oh, man. Okay.
And he convinces me to get off there and come into the townships with him and have a beer. Now, the townships, you know, this is 3 years after the end of apartheid. I'm a white guy. I symbolize everything wrong in the country. And this guy's a black South African teacher, but I'm up for an adventure. And I was 20 years old. And so I go with him, and we go into this, he calls it a tavern. It looks like a shack to me. And as you know, seen in the movies, everything goes quiet. Everyone looks at me, and music stops.
I'm thinking,
I'm going to get killed tonight. That's what I thought, right? And at the corner of the room, one guy motions me over, and it's this guy, Banks, Guacamole. And Banks says to me, we start talking. We have a bunch of beers. And at this time, I was an entrepreneur, but I had nothing to do with education or social anything. really? And he says to me, I'm a school teacher. Why don't you come work in my school? And I said, okay. I needed a job. I said, but I need a place to live. And he said, why don't you come move with my family then? So that night, I moved in with his family.
No way.
I'm living in this community. And, you know, these communities have all the poverty that's, I mean, you could, you know, it's as poor as any community in the world. I don't like to compare poverties, you know, one place to another, but yes, 90% unemployment, there's rampant abuse. One of three of the girls that, you know, we work with today are raped by the age of 18. It's very, a violent place. But it was also, I probably overly romanticized it, right? Because in the back of my mind, I knew I could always leave. And these 6 months in these communities, I didn't leave this area during this entire 6 months. And I immersed myself here. And what I saw, though, were all these organizations, big global nonprofits, you know, everyone dumping money into South Africa post-apartheid, all this philanthropic money. But everyone was defining success by, you know, how many computers they'd pass out, how many library books they'd hand out, or how many cups of soup they'd hand out. And I kept looking at these little kids who'd been abused or living in these shacks, and I'm thinking, how is a cup of soup and a wind-up computer going to change your life? It's not how I got to where I was. And I just kept thinking about how much was invested in my life. And that was really the beginning of a Ubuntu Education Fund. So I left South Africa after 6 months, and I went back to Philadelphia and held a raffle on my campus. Back then, I don't know how old you are, but they used to give out credit cards on college campuses, so I took eight of them. I started a Ubuntu Education Fund, and the idea was, let's take the bottom of the bottom, the kids who've been raped, the kids who've been lost their parents, and let's invest in them the same way, you know, someone invested in me. And let's work with them every day of their lives. You know, in our nonprofit sector, it's all about what's the exit strategy. You know, there's no exit strategy when you raise kids. And, you know, over the last 17 years, we've built this model where today we call it cradle to career, but we actually start with pregnant mothers today. We take HIV-positive pregnant mothers, and we ensure a healthy birth, and then we work with these kids every day of their lives until they're employed, either through a job training program or university.
Wow. So wait a minute. Were you still in college when you took this six-month trip there?
Yes, I was.
So did you, like, skip a semester, or what?
Yeah, my professor helped me take my exams early, and I went through the summer, and I sort of stayed later than I was supposed to.
Wow. So how did you have the courage to just jump on a train and go 18 hours in any direction that you had no clue where you were going? I mean, how did you...
I didn't really know how to get out of Cape Town. It wasn't what I was looking for at a bet. You know, I got there, it was just, I was totally scammed, and I felt afraid, and I just was looking for something. I was, you know, I felt very comfortable. I traveled my whole life, and I felt, even though I was quite young then, I felt very comfortable doing that. And part of it was, my own naivete, right, and a sense of adventure. You're 19.
That's true. And you were by yourself.
You know, bar, you'll go.
Wow, that's crazy. So, okay. So tell me, what first does Ubuntu mean?
So, Ubuntu, that was best described to me when after 6 months living with Banks and his family in the townships, he brought me to the train station, and it was interesting. Actually, that morning, he woke me at 4 in the morning. It was the last day I was there before bringing me to the train station, and he wakes me at 4 in the morning, takes me somewhere to this area called White Location. It's just shacks as far as you can see, and in front of each shack was a fire, and I saw these little girls in front of each shack holding bricks over the fire and then using the bricks to iron their school uniforms so they look proud to go to school. And that was the moment where I'm like, shit, we gotta do something. Like, the fire was literally burning. Like, these kids wanted to go to school. There was something we could do. And so Banks brings me to the train station from there, and he thinks he'll never see me again. And, you know, I'm gonna go aboard this train. I said, let me ask you something. What is this thing that you have that you just invited me into your home? Like, I represented everything wrong in South Africa as a white guy on the surface. Yet you brought me into your home. You have a tiny home. You let me share a room with your children. He said, oh, that's Ubuntu. I said, what do you mean that's Ubuntu? He said, well, it doesn't matter your race, your politics, or your religion. Shouldn't the fact that we're human beings be enough that we treat each other with respect? I'm thinking, God, what a beautiful concept. And it's what I experienced over. It's a way of life. You know, Archbishop Tutu, Desmond Tutu, who's worked very closely with us, always describes Ubuntu as a person through a person, which is something I really like, that, you know, as human beings, we're defined as people by the way we treat each other. Powerful stuff.
It's amazing.
And that's why I called the book is I Am Because You Are, which really means Ubuntu.
Right. So So what did you decide to do next? You did the 6 month experience there. You went back, and then what made you want to come back and really?
I went back, and I said, I couldn't care less about school. By the time I got back, I was like, I got to do something, and I had to, I knew I could do it. I knew I had that ability to mobilize resources and people, and I just started gathering friends around and telling them my stories. And and you know, this was a time before, right? Teach America, before all these social, before social entrepreneurship was even a word on college campuses, right?
Mm-hmm.
In fact, my college advisor said to me, oh, this is nice, but what are you really going to do when the summer's ends? This is a nice little project. It wasn't like today where everyone goes into the nonprofit sector.
Yeah.
I had all these people telling me, you can't do that, you can't,
right.
can't do that, you can't do it. And I think that probably drove
fire
me.
Fire the fuel, yeah, yeah. Fuel the fire.
Absolutely. I hate being told I can't do something.
I love that. So when did you go back then? After you came back when you're 20, 21, and then you went back.
So I'm 21. I'm graduating college. I raised some money, and I decided I'm really going to do this, right? But I had no money, and the first thing I did actually with a buddy of mine is I got in my car and we drove up to the Arctic Ocean, and we spent 4 months driving through Canada and Alaska and camping and fishing and just trying to get away. And I sort of worked on my whole business plan, worked on this all as I was out there. By the time I got back, my family lives up in Maine. I took a job on a commercial fishing boat. And in the evenings, I would write these grant proposals. And when I got my first grant proposal, I quit that job and moved to Philadelphia and really got Ubuntu going. And that was 1999.
Wow. So how much have you raised to date with this organization? Or is that?
Oh, over $40 million.
$40 million. Wow.
Yeah,
15 years, right?
Yeah, and it's the center of what we raise $6 million a year right now, and the centerpiece of everything we do is our Ubuntu Center. The Ubuntu Center it's a really fascinating project. So about 2005, I realized we had outgrown our space, and we need to build a new complex, a
home headquarters. Is this your space in South Africa?
Okay. Yeah, in South Africa. And I realized we had outgrown our headquarters, and I set out to interview architects, and everyone I interviewed in South Africa kept saying, well, you can't build this in the townships, you know, or show me an example. And I'm saying, no, this building's never been built before. And I finally met a guy out in Northern California who'd originally from the area we work in, but had been kicked out of the country in the 60s for opposing the police and so forth. And I spoke to this guy on the phone. Within 3 minutes, I hired him, and we set out to build a building that would win Global Architecture Awards.
Wow.
And people said, oh, that's Jacob's Vanity Project. What's the point of that when there's so much poverty? Why do you have to spend $7 million just on a building? But the point of it all was because we want to prove that access to great education, health care, shouldn't be a privilege for those, you know, raised in London or New York or L.A. It should be a child's right.
Yeah.
And that was important. So we set out to build this building, and 5 years later, we open a center that's as nice as any education or health facility you'll find in Manhattan.
Wow.
And it's powered by wind and sun. You know, Cisco wired it. Beck and Dickinson built our pharmacy and our clinic. Apple built the first iMac lab in the whole country there. And it's state-of-the-art education and healthcare in the middle of the shacks.
Mm.
And that's the way how you change people's lives. It's not about... You know, the question I'm always asked when I'm in New York fundraising or in Northern California is, we love what you're doing, but how can you reach more kids for less money? And that's the wrong question.
Interesting.
You know, it's not the question I ask with my own children, right? It's what does it actually take to take these kids out of poverty?
Mm.
And what we've learned is it takes a huge amount of resources. It's not cheap. And a child living in a shack in Africa who's been abused needs as much, if not more, than your child living on Park Avenue in Manhattan.
Right, right. Yeah. Wow.
And
they probably need to feel like they're worthy of it, too. And if they, you know, just get a little bit, as opposed to having it all essentially right in front of them, then they're never going to believe they're worthy to have it all until it's, you know, until they see that and they experience it and they get a taste of it.
Well, you know, that's actually such an interesting point, because when we were building this center, I mean, it took us 3.5 years to construct. We had one of these huge billboards outside where it was going to be outside the grounds, and it was a rendering of what the building would look like.
Mm-hmm.
And the kids would come around it every afternoon, and they would talk about it, and the word they would use is museum, is how it translates basically in their language, or Xhosa. And they would say why aren't you building this in town? Town meaning the other, because they felt it didn't belong in their community. It was too nice.
Mm.
And that's why we had feelings of inferiority, is one of the greatest legacies of apartheid.
Yeah.
The idea that I don't belong, and we needed to build this. And,
sure.
You know, the people who criticized us are from the funding community. You know, why would you spend that much money when there's so much poverty? Are the same people who send their kids to $50,000 a year
exactly.
elementary schools.
Exactly.
And it's okay, you know, and I'm dealing with the good people here.
Right, exactly. Wow. So what does it all include in this center? Healthcare, schools, what's included?
Psychosocial support, emotional, you name it. We do it. Everything from we got a robot. Right now our high school girls are building a robot in the robotics program. We've got, you know, kids doing a yearbook in the, you know, computer lab.
We've got
an early childhood program that's on par with anything you'd find anywhere. And so our whole model is about we're not about geographical expansion. Scale for us isn't about more locations across different regions. It's about how deep do you have to go into one child's life to change it. So we've got 2,000 children in our program ranging from zero or in the mother's womb all the way through to, you know, university and into employment. And if we can take 2,000 children who would have otherwise gone down a life of whether it's crime, survival, who knows, right?
Mm-hmm.
And get them into employment, we'll have changed the world.
Wow.
And so my passion is about how do we challenge people to think differently about philanthropy and not just say it's about reaching more and more kids, because what we're doing is we're reaching them with a cup of soup as opposed to, you know, reaching less kids and actually changing their lives.
Mm-hmm. Right. That makes sense. So this is so fascinating. Do you build schools as well, or is it just a center that has like all these different programs there, or do you work with the whole community, or how does it work?
We work with the whole community. We work in a 7-kilometer zone. We don't actually build. We have schooling from 0 to 5, and then we have after school and weekend and so forth.
Programs.
And then at 5 years old, yeah, we put the kids back into public schools. And then
so it's more of like an after school program, a healthcare center, an educational learning center where they can continue to come in and get additional
support they need. But also the glue of it all is, and what people don't realize, it's a kid, no matter how good your school is or your center in our cases, the child will always spend more time at home, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you're investing a kid in math and science and education and then sending him home to an environment where they're being abused or mm-hmm. there's no roof or there's no food, it's not going to work. It's a bad mm-hmm. investment. And I hate to be that guy, but that's just the truth. So much of what we do is what we call household stability. Go into the child's home, stabilize it, make sure the young mother's getting what she needs. Because we found that once the mother dies, the house becomes destabilized, right? And that's where kids move into transactional sex or crime for survival.
Range Rover Sport leads by example. Picture this: assertive on-road performance meets commanding all-terrain capability. That's the third generation Range Rover Sport, which is the most desirable, advanced, and dynamically capable one yet. This vehicle redefines sporting luxury, offering an instinctive drive with engaging on-road dynamics and effortless composure. Now available in sleek new Stealth Pack, Carpathian gray exterior wrapped in satin protective film with black accents and black brake calipers. Inside the Range Rover Sport, advanced cabin technologies like active noise cancellation and cabin air purification offer new levels of comfort and refinement. And let's not forget about the award-winning Pivi Pro infotainment system. Enjoy a dynamic drive and total comfort with optional 22-way adjustable, heated, and ventilated electric memory front seats with massage function. Wow, that's like a spa day while on the go. Design your Range Rover Sport at LandRoverUSA.com.
One of my favorite parts about my job is that I get the opportunity to travel a lot. And in fact, I'm recording this right now while I'm in Mexico. And actually, I was thinking about something that I wanted to share because I get a lot of questions from so many people about different side hustle ideas. So here's one for those of you out there that are on the go a lot like I am or traveling a lot. When you're staying in your Airbnb on your trips, have you ever thought about how you could be making extra money by hosting through Airbnb while your home is vacant? If you're interested in an extra stream of income, Airbnb hosting is an easy place to start, and it's like giving your home some company while you're away. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
When you get a new car or a new home, your first reaction might be to say things like, oh yeah, or I can't believe it, or booyah. But what you really want to say is the one thing that can get you the help you need. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. State Farm is there with the coverage you need for your car, your home, and even boats, motorcycles, RVs, and other things that matter to you. With a State Farm agent, you know someone is there to help you choose the coverage you need. With so many coverage options, it feels good knowing you can find what fits for you. And when you need ways to get help, State Farm gives you options there too, in person or on the phone with your local agent, or on statefarm.com, where their award-winning app State Farm lets you do things your way. So when you need help protecting the things that matter most, remember to say, like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
And keeping a young mother alive is, you know, 65% of the battle.
Wow.
So
how do you go and support these homes, or how do you go into these homes? Do you have locals?
We have family support specialists on our team who go out there into the home. We analyze what's happening in the home. We make sure there's a roof that's not leaking. There's electricity. There's there's HIV drugs available for young mothers. Basically anything they need. And, you know, what we always say, our slogan, you know, internally is, you know, we believe our children deserve what children all around the world deserve. Mm. And that's everything.
Sure. Yeah. Having it all.
Having it all. And you need it all. And that's the truth. And you know what? We don't talk enough about, and this is why I wrote the book more than anything, is how much of this doesn't work. This is really tough work. It is. Most of what we do, most of what everyone else does in this sector doesn't work. And that's okay. And we need to take create an environment where it allows groups like us, like Adam and Pepsi Promise, to talk honestly about what's not working without fear of losing funding or people criticizing us. Because that's the only – there's no – you know, if we were all doing half of what we said that we were doing, there'd be no poverty in the world. Right. And we need it's an effort not just from the nonprofit organizations, but also from the funding community to come together and say – that's really, failure is okay. Risk is, you know, this it really is okay. You know, you got to Northern California, everyone's running around talking about all their startups that never made it, failed, right?
Right.
You're in the nonprofit world, you get a summit series, not one person there will talk about a nonprofit endeavor they did that wasn't successful.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that? I don't know.
Yeah, and it's taken 15 years, and you're still growing and learning and probably making a lot of mistakes along the way and figuring out ways to go deeper into these lives as opposed to expanding right now. Do you have any great like success stories of young kids who've grown up and who have like maybe moved to Johannesburg and now is a leader in the community or making an impact in other areas of the country or moved outside of the country? Or,
you know, one of the families I sort of weave through my book, and the book is not just the narrative of building a Ubuntu Education Fund, but it's also sort of, as I was saying, challenging the whole philanthropic community to sort of shift the conversation. But I use one family's experience, and it's the Njeza family. And we met them, the oldest girl, Zaitu, was 12 years old at the time, and she had two younger siblings, and both their parents died of HIV within 6 months of each other, and they were left, this 12-year-old, to raise her younger siblings in a shack. And we move in, and this family's now been with us for over 12 years. Zaitu is now has a university degree and is now working in a headhunting agency, actually,
wow.
A recruitment agency. Her younger sister, Lungi, is studying to be a radio multimedia DJ type thing. And then the younger brother, the middle brother, a star, is in prison for life for armed robbery. So it's an example, you know, nothing's ever perfect, right?
Sure.
And I use that example because I want us to remember that there's a lot of ups and downs, and there's a lot we can't control, meaning we can work with a family, but, you know, there's so many external.
People make their own decisions still, whether they have the best of everything. You know, some people who have the most privilege and grow up in the most wealth actually rebel the most. Sometimes and go to prison, and that happens. You know, my brother went to prison for a number of years as well for selling drugs, and now he came out and he's the greatest jazz violinist in the world and he's redeemed himself. But, you know, sometimes people have internal emotional battles that they can never get through, and that causes trouble for them.
Absolutely. I mean, you nailed it. That's exactly right. I mean, we talk so much, but I think we've learned two big lessons in all this. One is, if you're not motivated to take control of your life, there's nothing we can do.
Exactly.
Meaning, we only work with what we call motivated clients. If you don't want to work, exactly. That's okay.
Yeah.
You know, we'll never kick you out for giving effort. Right. You know, for failing a test, you won't be kicked out. You'll get kicked out if you don't show up. If you don't, we need the effort.
Exactly.
And the second big lesson I think we've learned is that you've got to start early. Mm-hmm. And for us, you know, most of the world, parenting begins when a child's born. And the truth is, it's not when a child's born. It's when the mother becomes pregnant.
It's the mother educating them.
Yeah, we're educating them, and what goes into their body correlates to a child's mental development, the cognitive skills, on and on and on. And so, you know, those are, I think, the two lessons we've learned is you've got to start early with your intervention. In this case, it's with a pregnant mom. And you need a motivated client.
Mm, yeah. And I'm curious, you know, there's a lot of my listeners like to be in service and give back, and they're constantly giving back in their businesses and finding other ways to give back in their communities. And I'm constantly trying to encourage that. And that means I get to constantly do it myself and be the example. What are some pieces of advice or some tips you have for some people on if they have this urge to give back, but they don't know where to give back, how to give back, maybe they don't have the money to do that. What are some things they could do to really start living a life of service on a daily basis? What are some practices or some places they could research or dive into to see what works for them to start living that way?
I think most important is find something you really care about. Mm. You know, what are you passionate about? What's going to, because this is, like I said before, it's really hard work, and you have to have some connection to it to stick with it.
Yeah.
I think if you're going to commit, whether it's money, resources, time, energy, commit over a period of time. You know, I always tell people, give us a one-year grant, for example, or a donation. I can't raise a child in 12-month grant cycle, right? You know, stick with an organization for 3 to 5 years. Really learn, you know, ask their leadership. Get to, there's, you know, if any, I don't care how big or small a donor is, if someone calls our organization, says, I'd love to talk to your CEO and really understand, I'll make time for them.
Mm.
And ask that CEO, you know, what's working, what's not. Really try to, you know, understand their leadership, the philosophy, the dedication, you know, their theory of change. You know, ask the right questions. Don't get caught up with these, like, rating agencies, these charity navigators and this stuff. It's all BS. It doesn't, they don't know what they're doing. It's about getting to know the organization and believing in their leadership and, you know, and committing for a period of time and saying to them straight off the bat, I understand some of what you're doing may or may not work. That's okay.
Mm-hmm. Right. Like I said, I've had Adam Braun on here, and I've had Scott Harrison from Charity Water on here and built a relationship with those guys. And they've given some great lessons as well. And I'm curious, what do you feel like has really worked well for you in the last 15 years? And what is still not working? What's your biggest challenges still after 15 years of, you know, struggling and getting to where you are now? What's the biggest challenge moving forward? And what's the vision for the next 15 years?
That's a huge question. So what's really worked for us is about staying focused, right? We're in one area.
Not shiny balls, like going to the next, you know, city or trying to expand or do things, but just diving deep.
Yeah, being prepared and having the discipline to say no to money. Not all, I think one, you know, it took us a long time to learn, but not all money is equal.
Mm.
Not every dollar is worth the same. And so, you know, we used to raise $8-9 million a year, but we were taking a lot of this huge foundation money and government money that was forcing us to do things we didn't like. You know, we called it drug money. It was sexy. It was exciting. It would get us to big conferences, but it was killing our soul. You know, we were getting it was very glamorous, a lot of stuff attached to a lot of this money. And having the discipline to say no, to turn it down if it's not right for your organization. You know, I made an analogy to, you know, startups in Northern California, but you're in Silicon Valley with a tech startup. You spend a lot of time talking about who you want investing in your company, right? What should your portfolio look like? And we don't do enough of that in the nonprofit sector. And I'm really encouraging, you know, nonprofit leadership to have that discussion with their team and not just take all money because it's there, because a lot of it can do a lot more harm than good. Remember that, you know, as a nonprofit, you know your business better than others. You know, just because some guy made billions of dollars trading Uber doesn't mean he knows how to steer global health, right?
Exactly, yeah.
And I mean, he might have some great ideas, but it's a good, you know. And I say that because there's oftentimes a lot of those with the financial means dictate the agenda.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to listen a lot more to nonprofit leadership. So you mentioned Scott and I have both spent a good majority of their careers understanding their issues, right? Global
yeah.
education, clean water initiatives. Let them tell you what needs to be done.
Yeah, that's cool. Okay.
So where is this all heading for us? I think one of the biggest frustrations before I get to that for us has been, and what we continue to struggle with is we work in one little corner of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you attract the massive funding? Now, if I wanted to expand to 7 regions, we could climb to a $20 million organization pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you continue to sell people on the idea?
On one little town.
Yeah, and let me tell you something. Sustained success isn't exciting for people. It's weird. Like, you know, if you had your money in some stock that just kept going up each year, going up, you wouldn't take your money out. You'd leave it in.
Mm-hmm.
But in the nonprofit sector, people get bored. They want the next big magic bullet. And what we've realized is there's no magic in raising children.
Right.
You know, it's just
time, energy, and a lot of love.
A lot of love, a lot of hard work, a lot of energy. That's all it is. And that, so how do you, from a marketing standpoint, think Scott has just done? I mean, you mentioned Scott and Charity Water. I mean, I look at what they've done as a model from the branding perspective. And how do you reinvent yourself in a way you know, to constantly come up with new ways of selling yourself, and they do it very well.
Mm-hmm.
Really, they really do. So that's what we've struggled with is you know, taking constantly having to reinvent ourselves to sell the same,
sure,
you know,
okay.
same product, really.
Well, what's the vision then moving forward?
Sure. So it started with about 4 years ago. Someone approached me about starting an Ubuntu in Bridgeport, Connecticut. These hedge fund managers in Greenwich did. And they said, here's $1 million to open Ubuntu there. And at first I got really excited. We opened champagne. We were pumped. And then by that evening, we were like, what are we doing? We don't want to do that just to prove we can do it. I have no energy to do it. I have no interest in that community. So it started us on this journey of trying to figure out what do we want to do? How? And so then we started looking at the franchising world. And I learned a lot from the franchising world on how to build systems and so forth. I mean, right? I mean, Starbucks, you get the same latte anywhere in the world, but it's still a Starbucks latte. It's not your little artisanal coffee shop that knows where their beans come from and the barista can put a flower in there, whatever. And I use that analogy because I realized at Ubuntu, being in one, you know, we see ourselves as that boutique, of that sort of gold standard in nonprofit work. So how do we take this now 17 years knowledge and share it with others and really try to drill down on what it is we're best at? And what I figured out is if you want to study public health, Paul Farmer and Partners in Health, they do better than us, right? If you want to study global health, global education, the people who do better than us.
Mm-hmm.
What we've really done is created a community institution that's thriving. And I say that because I look at successful communities everywhere in the world, and the cornerstones of these communities are functioning institutions. And in poor communities everywhere in the world, what's lacking are institutions, right? And at the end of the day, it's all we are. Today, we're dealing with, you know, these 10 services. Tomorrow could be something else. We're positioned to address these other issues. And so we've fallen on this idea of creating some sort of institute where we can train the next generation of entrepreneurs who are committed to building community institutions, who see scale not in your geographical expansion, but in sort of going deeper into one community. So going back to that Bridgeport, Connecticut, I'd like to find the young kid who grew up in Bridgeport, Connecticut, and he or she went on to get her MBA at Yale and wants to go back and start a center there.
Right.
That's who I'd want to work with, as opposed to me building the center there.
Sure. That's great. That's great.
So that's where I see we're heading. We're a little ways off on it, but it's our way of taking what we've learned and sharing it in a meaningful way with the larger world.
I love that. I have got 4 questions left for you, Jacob. And
right,
this has been great so far. And I want to make sure everyone goes and gets a copy of your book. It's called I Am Because You Are. I'll tell people at the end here. I'll have it linked up on the show notes, but you can get it in pretty much any bookstore you can think of. Check it out and come back to the show notes when I share with you where to go for that here in a second. The first question of the 4 is, what are you most grateful for in your life recently?
What am I most grateful for?
Yeah.
I think it's the health of my own kids and that I'm able to provide them. I have 2 little boys. My 4-year-old's named Freedom. My 2-year-old's Madiba after Nelson Mandela. And that they are I see the kids we work with in South Africa who are simply dealt the raw hand, right? Any of us could have been born in that situation.
Yeah.
I look at my two boys and I just think, God, it helps me keep everything in perspective how lucky they are.
Yeah. Awesome. I love that. And the second question is, if you could, from all the lessons you've learned, all your travel, the work you've done in South Africa, you know, everywhere you've lived, all the people you've served and helped, if you could distill down to three lessons that you've learned so far in your life, that you would share with the world as the three things, are the biggest lessons to life, what would those three truths be about life?
I think one is make sure you love, right? It's this idea of Ubuntu, this live your life by loving those around you. This idea of Ubuntu has just changed my life so much. This idea that, you know, we're defined by the way we interact with one another. When I saw that really thriving in this idea of Ubuntu alive in the townships of South Africa, where there were these communities haunted by this legacy of apartheid and how brutally violent they were, yet this love for each other, this idea of community, it made me really believe in community and love and this idea of our interconnectedness. And so I think the biggest lesson is to sort of embrace that and find where you can make a difference, whether it's your own family, whether it's your religious community or school community, wherever it is. You know, we're here for such a short time. Make sure you're making the world a better place and not just take from it. Mm. I think the second lesson is to achieve anything, you better stick with it. Mm. It's a lot of hard work to be successful at anything in life, no matter what it is. I think three is remember to surround yourself with people who are smarter than you. And I say that when I look at my business, I've surrounded myself with brilliant people who could, you know, and remember that those you choose to walk with, through life, are the ones who will help you either, you know, move to achieve your goals and realize your potential or take you down.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's powerful. I love those lessons. Thanks for sharing that. Now, if you could, the final two questions, if you could leave behind three books to the world without not being your book, but if you leave behind three books to the world, and only three books that everyone could read in the world, what would those three books be?
There is a book that I read to my kids every night, based off of the, no, I'm serious.
All the places we'll go?
Nope. It's called, the guy who adapted it, Ashley Bryan, who's an old family friend. And it's, What a Wonderful World, based on the Louis Armstrong song. Mm. And it's a illustrated book to that song. And it's incredibly powerful.
Hmm.
And it's a children's book, but I suggest everything. It's beautifully done, and it's very powerful. I think
what's that called?
Nelson Mandela's Long Walk to Freedom.
What was the first book called?
The first one was called What a Wonderful World.
Okay,
by Ashley Bryan.
All right.
Second one, Nelson Mandela's Long Walk to Freedom. His journey, his book. It is amazing to see someone who spent that much time in jail be able to come out, and his first words were, "We will not forget, but we will forgive."
Mm-hmm.
What an amazing thing to be able to do. You look around the world at all of the conflicts that are continuing to go on, or, you know, I meet people who still to this day, you know, survivors of Holocaust who won't speak to, and I'm not saying that's right or wrong, by the way, to speak to a German person, or and to see this person who he himself lived through it be able to really just say, to say we are going to forgive. And I think that is such a, I just think it's such a powerful, concept.
Mm.
And then I think finally the idea that, the singularity is near, which is a book I've read recently, about the future. And it just captured me. This idea of where technology is leading us, and I'm totally enthralled by it. So I think those are the three, how technology and humanity is becoming one, basically.
Mm.
And so I think those three books would be three interesting ones.
That's great. I love those. Well, before I ask the final question, I want to take a moment, Jacob, to acknowledge you, because as I've been listening to you during this episode, this interview, and as I'm looking at the cover of your book right now, there's a little child, a girl who's on the cover. She's probably like 7, 8, 6, 5, 7, 8 years old. And she has the biggest smile on her face, and she looks whole and complete and excited about life. And I want to acknowledge you for your vision and your commitment and your love, because 15 years of your life is a lot to serve to one community. And just hearing about this, reading your book, seeing the image alone on the cover of this book makes me know that your heart is so big and you're so committed to making a change in people's lives in that community that I see the change in this photo. And so I want to acknowledge you for, you know, 15 years, man. That's a lot of your time and energy in life to stay committed to one thing and being focused on that community. So I really acknowledge you for your commitment, your vision to stick it out, and your love, because it's really inspiring. So thank you for all you do.
I really appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah. And the final question is, what's your definition of greatness?
Well, I think greatness is when you can improve the lives of those around you.
Jacob Leaf, thank you so much for coming on, my man. I appreciate this.
I really appreciate it. Look forward to catching up over a beer or coffee or something.
And there you have it, guys. Thank you so much for tuning in today's episode again. For me, very inspiring to hear the stories and the lifestyle of individuals who are literally changing the world by making an impact in the lives of others. And it doesn't have to be millions of people. You don't have to say, you know, I'm going to, you know, change everything about the world, but really changing one person's life and lifestyle and mindset and supporting that growth is going to change the world by supporting a few people. So don't think like you have to change everyone's world. Just focus on improving yours, improving the lives of at least one other person. I appreciate you guys. I hope you enjoyed this. Make sure to share this with your friends, lewishouse.com/199. Share that out with your friends on social media. We are one episode away from episode 200. I can't believe we're 200 episodes almost into the podcast. Very excited about this. I'll do something special for you on episode 200. So make sure to come back when that comes out. I appreciate you. I support you. I'm here to serve you. And I love you very much for being a part of this community. And you know what time it is. It's time to go out there and do something great.
If a friend asks how you're doing, and you say,
I'm okay.
When the truth is,
I don't want my problems to burden anyone.
Or you say,
hang it in there.
Because,
if I ask for help, they'll just think I'm weak.
Then this is your sign to call, text, or chat. 988 for free, confidential support. Anytime. You don't have to hide how you feel.
At Metro, get an iPhone 12 with 5G and a dual camera system for $99.99. Take amazing pictures and share them instantly. And don't put up with life's yada yada.
Yada yada.
Like photo bombers. Zoom, crop out,
yada yada,
and bye.
You don't take yada yada in life, don't take yada yada from your wireless provider. Get iPhone 12 with 5G with no activation fees and nada yada yada. Only at Metro by T-Mobile. Switch to Metro, bring your ID. This offer isn't available for customers currently at T-Mobile or that have been with Metro in the past 180 days.